Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the summer of 2010. Sorry for the infrequency of posts in the last fortnight, but final grades are now submitted and the summer has officially begun. I'd like to start things off with an episode recorded a while ago, but which I didn't have time to release before. It's a really fun conversation I had with my former student, Elizabeth Bateman, Washington College, class of 2009. Liz did her senior thesis on Tolkien, and it was titled, Not All Tears Are an Evil, Tolkien's Theory of Beautiful Tragedy in the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings. Last spring, Liz also presented a paper drawn from a chapter of her thesis at the annual Tolkien Conference at the University of Vermont, the only undergraduate to have a paper accepted to that conference. I referred to Liz's thesis at least once during the Tolkien class this past semester, and I was glad to get the chance to sit down with her and talk over some of the points she raises in her argument. We start with Liz's description of how she got interested in her topic.
Well, what originally, reading the books for class, it was kind of interesting because we read The Silmarillion first and then The Lord of the Rings, which the last time I'd read them in high school, I'd swapped that, which made it very difficult to read The Silmarillion because I was like, I don't even remember how this relates to like anything anymore. But anyway, so I'm reading the Fellowship and I get to the bit on Weathertop when Aragorn is talking to the hobbits and he stops Frodo from the Black Riders are all around and they're all worried and they're sitting around the fire and Aragorn stops Frodo from telling this story about Gil-galad, which I would think that he'd want Frodo to talk about how Sauron was defeated and it was really great. I mean, he's back now, but back then it was really great. But he's like, no, don't talk about that. Don't talk about that. I'm going to talk about, you know, this other Dark Lord who's even worse and how, like, he made everyone really miserable a long time ago. And he tells the story of Beren and Lúthien. And he's like, yeah, it's really super, super sad, but it's going to make you feel better. You know, I promise. Clark doesn't say it quite like that. It's just me paraphrasing. But, and then, you know, the hobbits really do feel better afterwards. And then, you know, after Aragorn stops telling the story, Frodo's all, you know, they get worried again and everything.
Yeah,
and
well, it's interesting because the Black Riders, that's like the moment when the Black Riders are closing in on the Dell. And the way, I mean, it's like immediately after Aragorn stops singing that they start closing in and everyone's like, I have a very uncomfy feeling right now. And of course, it's because the Black Riders are like right outside the Dell coming in. So, I mean, it gives almost the impression that the Black Riders are right there waiting to attack, except they're not while he's singing. Like, they can't come in while he's singing the song of Beren and Lúthien, but as soon as he's done, you know, it's the green light for the Ringwraiths to come in and charge. So, I mean, there seems to be almost really a direct link. It's more than just comfort, right? I mean, it's actual, like, prevention in that sense.
And I also thought it was really interesting now since I had just read The Silmarillion. I was like, wait a second, because Aragorn doesn't talk about the whole, like, and then they got to come back from death, and it was really great, and he makes it sound like, he says, like, you know, and after, yeah, and they came back, and after a brief time walking, you know, they died again. But it's like, after they came back from death, they had to have been there at least, like, 20 years, because, like, their son, like, grew up and left home. So, I mean, they were actually alive for a long time, like, together, happy. Right. And he, like, just completely blows over, like, and then Lúthien died and everyone's really sad and that's the end of the story. And I remember being like blown away. I was like, why would he tell the story that way? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so. It's doubly counterintuitive in that way, right? I mean, you've got, as you said, there's the triumphant story, which would seem like absolutely the best one to tell, right? Yeah, okay, let's talk about, in case any, you know, minions of Sauron are listening, how Sauron got his butt kicked before by Elendil and Gil-galad and everybody. But no. Let's not tell that story. But, you know, but instead, let's tell Beren and Lúthien. Now, and of course, as you say, that's a triumphant story, too. Mm-hmm. In some ways, even more triumphant than the defeat of Sauron in Mount Doom. But that's not what he emphasizes. Aragorn, like, almost aggressively skims over the triumphant aspects of it. It's the sadness of it that he emphasizes.
Yeah, he just completely passes it off.
Yeah.
In a brief time. Come
yeah,
on now.
You know, and like for a while, they were alive again. You know, it's like, well, they were resurrected. That was a big deal. But the resurrection isn't the point.
And he doesn't even make it clear that that's what happened. Like you said, you know, they came back, but it's really vague. You don't really, if you hadn't read the story, you wouldn't know what he was talking about. And he doesn't mention the fact that Beren went and stole a Silmaril from Morgoth's crown and no one had ever been able to like even get down there before. Or did even try.
Yeah. Well, of course, in that story, in the story of Beren and Lúthien, again, thinking of Sauron again, you know, Sauron's butt-kicking that he got at Mount Doom the first time from Gil-galad and Elendil was nothing compared to the butt-kicking he got at the hands of Lúthien. I mean, Lúthien single-handedly, you know, absolutely just blows Sauron out of the water, takes him prisoner, and, like, releases him when he begs for mercy. So, I mean, you know, but so again, that would also seem to be intuitive, right? Hey, well, awesome, great story to tell. Yeah, yeah, let's, in case any minions of Sauron are listening, let's tell the story about the time that, you know, this elven girl, you know, held your master down and made him beg for mercy. But no reference to that part of the story. And you'd think the temptation would be, I mean, at least my temptation, right? If I'm applying the Beren and Luthien story to that situation, even if I'm going to, for some reason, avoid the, hey, Sauron is fallible, see how evil can fall, we could beat evil again, because it's happened before, even to Sauron himself on several occasions. Even if you're not taking that angle, clearly, I mean, the most tempting take-home message from Beren and Luthien's story is that, hey, don't despair, right? I mean, there's hope. Even when things look horrible, there's hope, right? So here we are, and gosh, things look really bad right now, and the ring raids are kind of closing in, but don't worry, evil won't triumph even, you know, because here's Beren and Luthien, they triumph over death, Beren dies, and she goes and brings him back, and they're resurrected, and as you say, they live together in happiness for many years. But that's not the moral of the story. the moral of the story is instead, they're suffering the death.
Luthien died, and that was she was the most beautiful person ever, and now she's gone, and we're never going to get her back.
That's what he talks about. The choice of mortality and the consequences of that, and the tragedy of that, and how the elves, you know, it's like he tells it not from the human perspective, not sort of from Beren and Luthien's own perspective, but from the elven perspective, right? And they have lost, I mean, the last isn't, as I recall, his last line in telling it is, you know, and they have lost her whom they most loved, right? That's, so it's, whether or not, you know, you say that the story of Beren and Luthien themselves ends happily or tragically, to the rest of the elves, it's just tragic because she's gone. And of course, it's the same thing emphasized with Arwen and Aragorn, and with, you know, with Arwen and Elrond's parting at the very end, you know, and they parted, you know, who were going to be parted, you know, for all the rest of the history of the Earth. Yeah. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think, I mean, it makes sense that Aragorn would have that perspective because he grew up with the elves and all, but I mean, he's a man and he's talking to hobbits. I mean, they're mortal, so you'd think he'd be like, you know, mortality isn't so bad, you know, or something to make them feel better. But it was interesting that it does seem to make them feel better, all this talking about grief and everything, and I thought that was really interesting, so that's kind of what started me on the whole idea.
Well, and especially, you know, I think I just had an exchange with somebody over Twitter, actually, about the scene in the movie when Gandalf and Pippin are talking, when they're talking about death, and he is taking some lines from the book really significantly out of context. You know, that you know, people probably remember the scene in the film, you know, right, when it looks like the bad guys are going to win and they're all going to die in Minas Tirith. And Gandalf gives that speech to Pippin where he's like, oh, death isn't such a bad thing. And he tells them, like, seems to be describing what heaven is, or at least what the afterlife is going to be like, and describes the fair green country under a swift sunrise, which is a line from the book that is not a description of heaven or the afterlife at all. It's that line in the book is from the last page or the second to last page of The Return of the King. It's Frodo's experience and sensation as he sails on the ship into the west. It's Valinor, which is the far green country under a swift sunrise, not the afterlife. Frodo is going to go to Valinor, die, and then go to the afterlife.
Yeah, ironically, mortals can't stay there at all. It's like overdose of divinity or something.
Right, yes, exactly.
Like
just
poisonous.
Too much bliss for mortals to handle. Yeah, it's just an absolute bliss overload. But again, the interesting there is not just the way that they sort of transposed that line and also claimed some things about the afterlife, which Tolkien never says about the afterlife. The whole point is that nobody knows exactly what happens to mortals. But, at least the elves certainly don't know what happens to mortals. But I think the really interesting thing there in the context, thinking back to the Weathertop point, is that the impulse that that Peter Jackson and the other writers of the film have in that moment is almost exactly the opposite of what Tolkien does in like cases. You know, there, when everything looks dark and the bad guys are closing in, Gandalf's message to Pippin in the film is, it's okay. It's really not that bad. This is not, it looks like a tragedy, but it's not really a tragedy because, you know, it's, you know, cheer up because like what's going to happen is going to be a good thing. And that's not the comfort is tragedy itself. I mean, Aragorn tells a tragic tale, and as you emphasize which is, I mean, I think it was one of the points that you made in your thesis, which I thought was so great. It's not just that he tells a tragic story, but the version of the story that he tells places all the emphasis on its tragedy and aggressively de-emphasizes the positive thing, the things from which you would seem most intuitively to derive hope in the way that Gandalf gives hope to Pippin in the film. So instead of saying, hey, cheer up, you know, look at the bright side of things, or, you know, things are going to get better, or, you know, tragedy is only like a temporary illusion. And instead, he comes down on tragedy. He emphasizes tragedy mm-hmm. in those moments. So, and that I think is a really fascinating, dynamic that I think we can see in more than one place mm-hmm. in The Lord of the Rings.
Like, the other passage that comes to mind is when Sam is in Mordor and he sees the star, and he does have a moment where he's like, oh, you know, actually things aren't that terrible, you right. know, but right. he also, and then he mentions the Beren and Lúthien, but again, he like completely like passes over most of the happy stuff, and they're like, yeah, and you know, and I think he says that, like, you know, that sometimes the sad stories are like the best ones to land yourself in, and
yeah.
and he says something with their story going on past happiness or something, right. you know, very right. big.
Yeah. It's just that they're, he says that the tragic stories might not be the best ones to get landed in, but the best ones
there,
to hear.
There you go. That's the right? one. Yeah. Get it mixed up.
Yeah, exactly. that's they go into darkness and beyond, mm-hmm. right? And yes, it is a fascinating thing. I mean, I, you're right to bring up that moment with the star mm-hmm. in Mordor. I mean, that's such a, you know, it's in the beginning of book six. Mm-hmm. That is the second half of the Return of the King. Right when it's one of the first nights that Frodo and Sam are together in Mordor after Sam has released Frodo from the Tower of Cirith Ungol, mm-hmm. and Sam is on watch, and he's looking up at the sky, and the clouds over Mordor part for just a moment, and he sees the one star up above, and he looks up, and in that moment he gains this sort of larger perspective and realizes that the shadow is but a small and passing thing, and there is always, you know, high beauty and mm-hmm. joy that is beyond its reach. So there's no question, and I think it's important to emphasize this when we talk about the tragedy. This is not at all to say either that Tolkien, you know, has like a broadly depressive point of view or that he's really pessimistic. It's not that he doesn't insist on that. He does. He insists on the fact that evil is ultimately helpless, that evil is a small and passing thing, that there is the good that is the outer framework of everything. You know, the good purposes and plan of Ilúvatar can never be affected by any evil choice of anybody. All consequences, no matter how terrible evil is, it's all a passing thing. And yet, that's not how we cheer people up.
Yes.
That's not, you know, when we tell stories, we don't tell, I mean, not that stories of triumph are never told, but mm-hmm. But in those moments, it's not from the stories of triumph that would seem to point beyond the local darkness and evil and out towards that wider context of good. Mm-hmm. It's not those stories that we tell. It's the journey into darkness. It's tragedy. And that's, again, it's counterintuitive. It's mm-hmm. very much not what you would expect.
And it's the same kind of thing where even though Sam is talking about how, you know, it isn't so bad, he still doesn't, like, if I were Sam and I know the story, I would start drawing and be like, hey, you know, like Frodo and I going into Mordor, it's kind of like what Beren and Lúthien did, was like going in, you know, in most dangerous place, and no one's ever done this kind of thing before, really, except with the whole army with them and things yeah. like that, you know. And like, you know, we're two people together, but he doesn't talk about that at all, you know. He's just like, yeah, well, we are in the same story, I guess. Yep. He just kind of, you know, goes on and does what he needs to do, and, you know, doesn't seem to draw any encouragement from the fact of it, you know. Hey, you know, this kind of thing has been done before, and you know, and they got out alive, kind of, you know.
Yes, kind of, temporarily, yeah. But that's the point. It's not mm-hmm. that, the point that Sam makes is that the story is with a happy ending. You know, because of course he and Frodo talk about, like, I wonder if our story is one of the ones with a happy ending or one with a sad ending.
Yeah.
And, And Sam insists that, you know, although, of course, anyone who is in a story would kind of rather it be a happy ending story, that the happy ending stories aren't the best ones to listen to. And again, this comes back to that same impulse that Aragorn seems to feel. You know, the phrase he uses to the hobbits when he's introducing the Beren and Lúthien song that he sings at, on Weathertop is, "This will lift your hearts," right? Mm-hmm. You know, I have just the pick-me-up that you need. And it's a sad story. Again, whose sadness is emphasized. As Sam says, it's not the happy ending stories that are always the best to hear, even when it seems like a happy ending story is really desirable under the circumstances.
Yeah. So, I don't know if that would be a good segue to talk about Nienna maybe for a little while. Because that was kind of where I went next and I was thinking about it. Because, well, why would a sad story be so much more powerful or ennobling or something? And it seems to be that, like, at the very beginning when they're fighting with Melkor over, like, songs and stuff, it's not like the big powerful song that finally defeats Melkor at the end. It's really sad little dirge kind of thing. Yeah. And they don't, it's not stated by the narrator if it's Nienna who's singing it, but I can't imagine who else it would be. Because, I mean, I remember the first time I read the Silmarillion, it was so strange to me because, like, you can kind of figure out which pagan god the Valar are parallel to. I'm like, okay, so Olmo is kind of like Poseidon, and okay. And then I'm like, and Nienna cries all the time. Okay. I was like, I remember being very confused. I'm like, I'm just gonna keep reading. I don't even know what's going on anymore. But it really seems to be her function. She's like extremely powerful, actually, even though she hardly ever see her do anything. I think I counted she's mentioned like 8 times.
Right, yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. And we should probably back up a little bit and explain some more about the music of the Ainur. At the very beginning of the Silmarillion, Tolkien describes the creation myth of Middle-earth and of Planet, which is called Arda. And he describes the chorus of these, well, they're like angelic beings. Exactly angels, but anyway, they're spiritual beings. Anyway, so they basically sing the world into being, their own, the music that they make before Ilúvatar, before God, is the fabric from which the creation not only of the world but of history is formed. And so, of course, during the music gets disrupted by Melkor, who rebels against the orchestration of Ilúvatar, seeks to glorify his own part, and then there's discord and there's strife in the music, and some sing with Melkor and some stay with the original themes. And when Ilúvatar opposes the music of Melkor, the one which undermines him most effectively, as Liz said, is this sweet, gentle theme, which is marked by sadness. And there's that wonderful line where he says, you know, that it was full of sadness from which its beauty chiefly came. That the sadness of the third theme is what makes it beautiful. It's not beautiful despite its sadness. It's beautiful because of its sadness. And that is the theme which Melkor is unable to oppose. So the Valar, the chief of the beings who are ruling over Middle-earth, you know, Liz, as you said, they have these major roles that they play. Mm-hmm. You know, Manwë, who is in charge of the heavens and the winds, and Olmo, who's in charge of the seas. But one of them is Nienna, who's in charge of sorrow, of lamentation. And she just, as you say, she cries a lot. Yeah. And it seems strange, as you say, I mean, very, very unusual in a pantheon to have you know, someone who's in charge of crying. But the even stranger thing is that she is specifically pointed out, although she's not referred to very much, as you say, one of the times that she is to point out that she's one of the most powerful of all of them. You know, that.
I mean, you'd almost think if she was the one who could defeat him in the first place, that she'd be a really good person to put up for, like, here, you, go deal with Morgoth, because obviously you have this, you know, but that's not her thing, you know.
Yeah. And you know, the emphasis, when he does talk about Nienna in the one, in one of the few passages in which he actually develops Nienna and who she is, he spends a lot of time talking about what the consequences, like, what her power is, as the, you know, what is in fact the use of a Valar of weeping? And she turns sorrow into wisdom. She brings comfort. not by just bringing people out of sorrow. You know, hers isn't like, hey, I'm going to help you stop being sorrowful, but rather I'm going to help you to take your sorrow and transform that sorrow into wisdom. Mm-hmm. The reason I think that she's so powerful, and the reason that she, as you say, although she's kind of in the background, seems to be one of the more potent anti-Melkor forces,
yeah,
is that it's like her job is to bring good out of evil. Mm-hmm. Right. And the worst evil, the evil which just leads people to weeping and lamentation, that she makes into blessing, not by removing it, but mm-hmm. by transforming it and by making that thing itself into its own kind of triumph without having it ceasing to be tragic. Because mm-hmm. it's the sadness of that theme from which its beauty comes, and that's what she's all about.
Yep, and I think Gandalf is specifically mentioned as having been spent a lot of time with her and learned stuff. So then reading The Lord of the Rings after that, you can kind of, he talks about how, like, oh, you know, you can't despair and we're going to, you know, work through this kind of thing. And then he got his whole, you know, all tears are an evil. And
yes,
it makes more sense if you're like, oh, okay, he's making reference to Nienna. Okay, now it makes more sense.
Yeah, when you see how, when you find out who Nienna is and what she's about, mm-hmm. and then learn that that Gandalf in his early days, you know, back in Gandalf's salad days in Valinor, he was like one of her, I don't know if disciple is the right word, but anyway, yeah, he spent a lot of time with mm-hmm. with Nienna. So yeah, hearing him say to the hobbits at the end of The Return of the King, you know, I won't say do not weep, for not all tears are an evil. You know, that's it does really kind of mm-hmm. kind of contextualize that without undermining it. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. he could say something like, more like the kind of thing that the Gandalf in the film says, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you guys are mortal. You all be dead in, you know, a few decades anyway at the outside. So it's only a temporary parting, right? And then, you know, you'll go to the, probably you'll be reunited in the afterlife or something. So buck up, right? I mean, it's not goodbye forever. But that's never the kind of comfort that no. Gandalf gives. And it's not what Nienna's about. Again, it's never about denying or even just like, let's contextualize suffering, right? It's the actual deriving of strength from the suffering itself, that mm-hmm. the not opposing evil with good, but transforming that evil into good in itself, and yeah, that's just a remarkable thing.
Again, also always associated with wisdom, which is another thing that Nienna, you know, turns it into wisdom and everything like that. So
yeah. And I mean, and his role in bringing comfort and encouragement to people, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's what he, I mean, think of what he does, of course, in Rohan rather spectacularly, right? And, you know, turning trouble and despair into confidence and you know, the his role as the encourager and builder mm-hmm. up of Theoden again. You know, and part of what he does there is to contradict delusions of dark. He tells him, go out of your hall and look abroad and you'll find it's not quite as dark as it seems. It's not just about the denial or the refutation of the evil. Now, of course, I'd say of in all of Tolkien's fiction, probably mm-hmm. the biggest challenge in the project of taking something sad and tragic and bringing good out of evil, the biggest challenge there would be the story of Turin Turambar. You know, in the Silmarillion, there are two major stories, you know, which take the longest, you know, the biggest sections of the Silmarillion to tell, and which really receive a lot of emphasis. They're like, you know, the two greatest of the stories from the First Age. I think that's fair to say that mm-hmm. they're the two greatest stories.
Certainly the longest.
They're certainly the longest, yeah. And Tolkien even says that. It's not just that they happen in the manuscript to be the longest. He actually says, you know, these are the two longest of all the stories that were told. One is the story of Beren and Lúthien, which we've already talked about some. And of course, the other is the story of Turin Turambar, which is the story which is told at greater length in the recently published Children of Húrin mm-hmm. Volume. That's a really sad story. You know, you want tragedy, there you go.
Right. Where you, like, kind of get to the last few pages and you're like, okay, can't get, okay, it really, wow. You know, like, it can't get much worse. Oh, wait, it just did.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And it's interesting because it's like the first time you really get an explicit, like, suicide. Like, yeah. Where, you know, actually jumping off a cliff, falling on a sword, walking into the sea. Like, you never really get Like, you get kind of an altruistic suicide, like, before that where somebody, like, sacrifices himself for somebody else. That's a little different, but it's not just, my life is so horrible that I can't take it anymore, and I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah, so. And it's not, and the thing is, the way the suicides are handled at the end of that story, that it's not, I mean, we want to be careful in talking about, but it's not obviously a bad thing. It's not obvious that their suicides are themselves an evil act at the end of those stories. I mean, it is the most, but it's like the logical fulfillment of the tragedy.
It's true. I mean, I'm sure if Turin had decided to not kill himself, his life would only have somehow found a way to get worse. I mean, yes. I don't even want to think about what other horrible things could have happened, but, I mean, yeah, definitely. The whole story seems to be just kind of like a study in, like, here's a character with some flaws, and we're just going to take those flaws to, like, the nth degree and see how he can, like, completely ruin his life, you know?
Oh, and I mean, and that's the thing about Turin that makes it, I mean, it's the combination of, right, you know, like, a bunch of the tragic things that happen are really his own fault. Mm-hmm. Some of them are not his own fault. I mean, he and his family are cursed by Morgoth, right, and so you've got the evil power of Morgoth looming over their lives and him manipulating, you know, through his agent, Glaurung the Dragon, and, you know, screwing with them. And you know, so they are doing all that they can to make their lives horrible and succeeding many, many times.
Exactly.
But then, of course, it's not just, it would be easier if you could just say, well, you know, he was persecuted, but he held up under it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, then you add on top of that his own flaws and the stupid things that he does and the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, he can't just look back and say, well, okay, my life sucked because I was cursed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he looks back and knows it was his own fault, you know, and that's in the moment of his suicide, that's what he emphasizes. And that's what the sword, when the sword talks at the end, you know, he speaks to his sword and says, will you take my life? It's almost like Turin doesn't even really kill himself. Like, he just, like,
it's true. The
gives himself
like,
to
okay.
his sword. Yeah, and the sword is like, yes, okay, I will kill you. The sword actually speaks. And when the sword speaks, it says, it talks about, it doesn't use the word atonement, but
The ones he's slain unjustly or something like that, yeah.
He cites the deaths, you know, that sword has been used by Turin to kill Turin's own best friend, Beleg Strongbow, in just one of the most horrible, heartrending moments in any story that I know of. And of course, and slay Brondir, the leader of the people who had taken Turin in, for understandable reasons, but yet unjustly, as the sword points out.
Yeah.
You know, so that basically it says, you know, I have been used, you know, by you, Turin, to kill several people unjustly. I will shed your blood. And he doesn't say, like, in compensation, but then basically that there's, from the sword's perspective, clearly there is an element of justice in the death of Turin there. And Turin doesn't oppose that. You know, he recognizes he has made a horrible mess of things, but it's not just him, right? He's not just, like, a really bad guy who's done horrible things.
But most of the things he does that make a certain amount of sense is just kind of like a mixture of his own kind of not good choices and then like the things that Glaurung does, it just combines to make a total mess.
Yeah.
So, and you can definitely see, it's interesting to see Turin get progressively like worse as he goes on, because he starts out to be like a pretty good guy, just a little prideful, and then like, but at the end he like, you know, when he kills Brandir, he just like whips out his sword and kills him for, I mean, yes, he said something that Turin didn't want to hear, but it wasn't like he was actually in danger, you know? You could understand the thing with Beleg, he thought he was going to be killed, so he whipped out his sword then, but, like, the thing with Brandir, it's just like, you know.
Well, and especially with the emphasis, you know, Brandir is club-footed, and I mean, so he's got this guy whom Turin mocks for not being able to be a warrior and fight for his people. So you've got this guy who's, like, literally helpless, and Turin, who's the great, you know, one of the greatest warriors of all time, and, you know, so just the way that it's, I mean, that's just like an execution. I mean, it's not even a fight. It's not even, he just, you know, he just murders Brandir. And again, he thinks that he is justified for doing it. And, you know, it's not that you can't see any of his rationale. And it certainly, you know, his anger at Brandir is understandable, but you just, you can't do that.
Yeah,
you just can't do that. So, but I mean, so all of these things contribute to again making this story, and of course we haven't even mentioned the incest and all that, but it's so sad. It is stuck. That story is so, as you say, unremittingly tragic. Like, you keep thinking it won't get worse, and it does. And yet, that story is also applied in positive ways.
Mm-hmm. Like, the only time when any character actually mentions Turin was in Elrond's talking about when Frodo first says he'll take the Ring of Mordor, he's like, compares him to Beren first, and then he mentions Turin in the same sentence with, like, elf friends, and seems to think, oh yeah, well, you know, Turin did do some good things, but, you know, completely skipped over the fact that Turin had, like, kind of directly led to the downfall of one of the biggest elf kingdoms ever, and, you know, killed some elves and done a lot of bad things.
Right, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's that speech when Elrond says, you know, Frodo, for taking the ring, basically you're going to go into the Elf Hall of Fame. You know, you're going to go into, well, not the Elf Hall of Fame, the Elf Friend Hall of Fame, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to be among the greatest, not even Beren, Turin, or does he mention Húrin?
I think so, yeah. He does mention Húrin.
Túrin's dad. Your place would be among them, right? So you're going straight into the Hall of Fame. But yeah, the big question is, well, gosh, like, why is Turin in the Hall of Fame, right? I mean, any purely pragmatic assessment of Turin's career, I mean, you kind of have to. I mean, sure, he was close friends with elves, and he had very close relationships with elves, and he was great in several dimensions. I mean, he was one of the strongest, one of the greatest warriors. One of the most interesting things, I think, the most beautiful, the most physically attractive man ever to live, which is sort of as an interesting item on Turin's resume, but so beautiful he's mistaken for an elf. You know, elf man is one of the things that he's, you know, one of his, like, 147 nicknames, but anyway.
Hard to keep track of all those.
Yes. But yet, I mean, again, when you look at what he actually does and what he actually accomplishes, I mean, you got to think, as far as, like, for the cause of elfdom in Middle Earth, like, his career was a net loss, right?
Yeah. I mean, even the friends he has who are elves, I'm pretty sure Beleg mentions at one point, you know, like, it probably would have been better if I hadn't met you. What's the name of the guy who was in love with Finduila? The elf dude.
Gwyndor.
Yeah, Gwyndor. And I know he says, at least in the Children of Hurn, he's like, yes, I wish I'd never met you. Right. You completely ruined my life. Right. And my life was already ruined. Right. You know?
I rescued you and nursed you back to health, and I really regret that now. In retrospect, that was a bad move on my part. Yeah, I mean, even though, at the same, he's not saying, you know, now I hate you and I'm being petty. You know, he's saying, look, I love you. I'm grateful to you, and I still admire and respect you, but at the end of the day, it would have been better had I not brought you back.
Yeah, but the fact that Elrond later on can say, you know, he was an elf friend.
Totally in the Hall of Fame, Turin. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that mention by itself is interesting. And, of course, one passage in the Silmarillion itself that I think is really interesting there, one of the most fascinating elements of that story is the bit at the very end that, you know, there's one place next to the river where Turin's sister throws herself off the cliff into the river and dies. Mm-hmm. Then Turin stabs himself and dies on that spot. And then his dad, Húrin, is released and goes there and finds their mom hanging out there, though she found neither one of them and doesn't know what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And then right after he meets her, she dies. And so he buries her there, and Húrin, being the only survivor of his family, all three of his children, and his wife are now dead. And so he buries her, erects a tombstone for the three of them, right, all of whom died right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just that fascinating description that monument is the one physical location that survives. At the end of the First Age, all of Beleriand, the whole subcontinent sinks beneath the waves. It's gone. It's except the gravesite of the children of Húrin and of Morwen.
Which seems really, really counterintuitive, especially if you think about, like, there are all these other really famous graves, like there's Finrod and Fingolfin, and well, Beren and Lúthien don't even really have graves. It's very mysterious. You never find out where they are, but you'd think people who had accomplished really great things or, like, sacrificed themselves for others. Like, I mean, that's pretty much what Finrod did. He was hanging out with Beren at the time. And so you would think that they would be way higher on the list of graves to be saved. And Turin would be, like, down at the bottom, you know. But But yeah, the fact that they're preserved, and it seems to be, who would have the power to do that? It would be, must be, Iluvatar would be the only person who'd be able to, do something like that is really interesting. It seems to suggest that his story did actually have some worth, some kind of positive aspect, even though it's really hard to see it at the end of the story.
Yeah, because, there is no... Tolkien leaves no naturalistic explanation for that fact, because it is certainly not true that it's the highest point. it's from a pure altitude basis. It's not like it's the highest point and therefore everything else sinks except that.
Right.
Mountain ranges fall and everything else, but this one spot of ground on the side of a river stays above the waves, and that's clearly very intentional. It's obvious that Tolkien is really shedding a spotlight. That when everything else in Beleriand is gone, in a sense, you get that as the physical marker of this tragic story, the resting place of the resting place. Of course, that phrase is often used very lightly. In this story, it seems particularly relevant and important. They're at rest, finally. Goodness knows, their lives were horrible. Now they're at rest. The resting place of the family of Húrin. That's, in the end, it's preserved as the monument of Beleriand, the whole First Age. That's the monument of the First Age. As you say, there are other things, the grave of Fingolfin, right, who valiantly goes and fights Morgoth hand to hand and wounds him, and that's really great. And his grave is made a big deal of, right? He's taken and he's buried, and the flowers ever grow upon his grave and everything. And it's up on a mountaintop even. I mean, how convenient would that be?
There's until everything sank beneath the waves.
Right, exactly.
And Finrod's grave did the same thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Finrod is buried on the island that Sauron took, where he built the city that was originally named Minas Tirith, that the Gondor city was named after. And so he's buried there. So yeah, you have all of these, and either one of them, it seems at first blush, would serve as a more fitting testament to what happened in the First Age. Mm-hmm. Right, here is the noble, with Fingolfin. Right, Fingolfin is a perfect representation. He's the guy. He's the High King of the Noldor in Middle Earth, and they're trying to barricade. Melkor and the orcs and all the forces of evil into his fortress in the north. And then, he breaks out and it looks like everything has fallen. So in despair, he goes, challenges Morgoth to single combat, is valiantly killed. And that would seem to be a perfect representation, right? Of the struggle of the Noldor, the hopeless struggle of the Noldor against Morgoth. And so that would be a great way to commemorate the First Age, right? That's like the First Age in a nutshell. But no. Finrod, okay, well, hey, there's another element there, right? Finrod dies to save Beren, right? So, okay, so you not only have the hopeless struggle of the Noldor against Melkor and his works, but also now the unity between the elves and men,
self-sacrifice.
Yeah, and this wonderful example of elves and men sacrificing for each other and working together, which doesn't usually happen, and that would be even better than the monument of Fingolfin. But no. The monument for the First Age is the family, the horribly tragic family of Húrin. It's a passing reference. It only gives it a few lines in the Silmarillion, but it is such a striking moment. In the end, I think it makes for a really bright spotlight that he shines onto that story. And of course, the length of the story, this is the longest story. This is,
I'm going to put down the tragedy story in excruciating detail. We're going to tell you every horrible thing that happened.
Exactly. And just in case that wasn't enough, in The Children of Húrin, you get another couple hundred pages of it. So again, we come back to the same thing. Mm-hmm. Let's spotlight the tragedy, not gloss over the tragedy, not contextualize the tragedy, not rebut the tragedy with positive and happy things, but really go there.
Yeah, and even they call it is it the Grave of the Hapless or the Stone of the Hapless? The Stone of the Hapless, I think, is what it's called, which is interesting. It's not even called, the Grave of Turin, that mighty warrior
that member of the Hall of Fame of elf friends. Right.
It's this is the grave of, people who, had no chance. There was nothing that they could have done, and it ended horribly, but here's their grave, and we should remember it, seems to be the emphasis there.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's... it is on their haplessness. That's what it's like a monument to haplessness, right?
Yeah.
To their misfortune, right? To the to the tragedy of their lives. I mean, it's like explicitly named that. Yeah.
Yeah. And even Turn's story seems to kind of the fact that it's like mortals who are buried there. It seems to kind of emphasize the whole, you know, humans kind of threw themselves in with the elves there. Like, it wasn't originally their fight, but by joining with the elves, they had to join in the tragedy.
Right, right, right. So the question then is, you know, all right, so at the end of the day, where are we? You know, obviously the big question is, so why? Why does Tolkien do this? You know, what is the function of tragedy that makes Tolkien not want to escape tragedy, but actually to dwell on it, to go there in times of distress? You know, why is it that the tragic elements of the story of Beren and Lúthien are going to lift the Hobbits' hearts? Why is it that the tragic story of Beren and Lúthien is what's going to keep the Ringwraiths at bay in Rivendell? That's the big question.
Yeah, well, it seems to me, I think in the Lord of the Rings it's a little more clear that the point of, like, you know, when Frodo and Sam and Mordor and things look really, really bad, that it wouldn't be good for them to be like, yeah, you know, but things might work out one day. Like, it's better for them to be like, you know, things probably aren't going to work out, but we're going to go anyway, and we're going to do the right thing, even though we probably won't be rewarded and things are probably going to go horribly, but we're going to do the right thing anyway. So that seems to be kind of the focus there anyway. And thought it was interesting when I was reading, like, other I couldn't find a whole lot on specifically on the Tolkien's treatment of tragedy, but when I would read other authors, they'd be like, yeah, and especially about Turns, they'd be like, yeah, and this shows that, you know, Tolkien was really pessimistic about humanity. And I was like, well, I don't know if that's really the take-home point. I mean, yes, he clearly thought that humans were deeply flawed, but the whole fact that they have this grave at the end and everything seems to point to that we can do better things.
Yeah, there clearly is value there. It's It does, just as the sadness of the third theme of the music of the Ainur at the beginning is what, you know, is you know, what works to undo, you know, Melkor, there is beauty in that sadness. It's not just, hey, everything's sad and therefore everything sucks. That's not the take home. And thinking back to Sam's reference about sad endings and happy endings, there's also, you can see some, and thinking about what you were just saying about, not comforting yourself in times of duress by saying, hey, maybe things are going to end well. You can see there's an element, and it's unclear whether or not Sam is thinking about this explicitly, but implicit in what he says is a sense of self-sacrifice, right? It's true that the sad ending stories aren't the best ones to get landed in, but they're the best ones to hear. That is, for the people, the principles in the story, it's not so great. But for those listening, it is great. In other words, good will be brought not to you, possibly, but good will be brought to others,
right?
By the fact, by through your tragedy, so that, you know, goodness knows there are lots of examples of triumphant stories, and one of the central ideas of Tolkien's concept of fairy stories and his essay on fairy stories, and you know, at the heart, or near the heart anyway, of the consolation and benefit of fantasy is what he describes as eucatastrophe, the good disaster, the sudden turn, you know, the eagles sweeping down in the battle of five armies when everything looks lost and bringing. So that idea of sudden and unexpected triumph, of grace being shown in this unexpected and dramatic way, is a huge element in Tolkien's stories. And that's what makes it, I think, so interesting. But it's not the whole story. Mm-hmm. The fact is, not all stories end happily. Not all people live happily ever after. Right. But
that doesn't mean that they're not really awesome stories.
Exactly.
And it seems to think that, especially the way that the Beren and Lúthien story, they always don't talk about, it seems to be like, there's also almost an idea that it would cheapen the story to talk about the happy parts. Be like, no. That detracts from the worth of this story. The worth is in the really horrible things that they had to go through.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's, you know, and so like I said with Sam, it's self-sacrificial, right? If you find yourself in a sad ending story, and let's face facts, your story might be a sad ending story. You know, Sam is confronting that reality in that moment. And the implication is that, well, all of our stories might be sad ending. Just because Tolkien's stories are often you catastrophic. That because he believes in happy endings, right? Mm-hmm. Remember Bilbo's comment at the end when he's talking to Frodo in Rivendell, right? And Bilbo asks Frodo if he's thought of an ending to his story, and Frodo says, "Yes, many dark and terrible ones." And Bilbo says, "Oh no, no, books should have good endings, right? They should have happy endings." But not all stories do have happy endings, and yet the point is the sad endings are good endings. Mm-hmm. They might not be happy for the people involved, but they're good endings. And good, just as Nienna brings good out of evil, just as wisdom comes from suffering and great good from evil that has happened. Mm-hmm. So even if your ending is a sad ending for yourself in the course of your life, good will come of that. It's really remarkable that Tolkien can do both of those things.
Yeah, it's really impressive, I guess.
Yeah. You know, he doesn't just hang on the one side of it. I mean, because anyway, and I've heard some people criticize Tolkien for the happy ending business. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like, oh, you know, like, oh well, but look, everything turns out well after all. And even, you know, in those moments, like with Bilbo, he seems to defend, no, stories should have good endings. And on fairy stories, he insists on that. You know, if a fairy story doesn't have a good ending, you know, doesn't have, you know, that you catastrophic turn. You know, it's not really a legit fairy story, right? So, but yet, somebody who insists on happy endings like that, people who would say, oh, it's so simplistic, it's so formulaic, you know, it's so, it's just escapism, that's not how the real world is. I mean, look, there's, you know, Tolkien is remarkable for being in touch with how the real world is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, not all stories do end happily, and yet, I guess the thing, you know, to sort of to tie it back again to that larger context, because it's still true, that vision that Sam has of the star above the shadow, it is true that at the end of the day, evil is a passing thing, and evil can never ultimately thwart the purposes of good. Mm-hmm. There are definitely happy stories, there are definitely sad stories, but in the end, they're all good stories.
Right.
And that, I think, is the amazing thing that he pulls off and pulls together in the end.
All right. I hope to post a number of these conversations this summer. The next one will be the conversation I had with Michael Drought last month during his visit to Washington College. I also plan to be available a little more regularly for Skype sessions and general Q&A. I'm always glad to hear from listeners and to try to answer any questions that you have. In fact, I plan to be available for a Skype session on Thursday, May 20th at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My Skype name is just Tolkien Professor without a space between the words. I look forward to hearing from you. I'll be posting reminders through Facebook and Twitter about that time as it approaches. I will also be going back to work on the Hobbit series starting next week, so look for Hobbit Lecture 5 Part 2 in the next week or so. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.